And hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Match Slip Podcast. My name is Frank Angeloni. I am your host. If you haven't already, I invite you to listen to our last episode with Bill and Ogres out in Murphy, North Carolina. But for this episode, we're going to be talking to Paul Butler out in Maryland. He is the owner of Games and Stuff. Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm glad to have you on the show, especially in the light of the fact that your store just moved to a new location.
Yeah, we reopened 10 days ago.
And how has it been going so far?
It's been great. It was a bit of a journey. I was hoping to be closed for about 4 or 5 days. We were closed for 10, but we are open and prospering.
How did the move all originate? Was it just the need of needing more space? Were you outgrowing your existing space?
So the lease was up on the old space. We'd outgrown it. You know, I mean, there's long been a phrase in the game industry that I've heard, game retail, which was don't move until you have to. And we absolutely had to. You know, we had, 5 pounds of, or 10 pounds of crap in a 5 pound bag. Our inventory was just exploding. We have 3 offsite storage units. Post COVID, we pretty rapidly developed an e-commerce site, which had been pretty far down my priority list. But when COVID happened, it shot way up there. So not only had our inventory really blossomed, and the nature of my buying, which I can get into later, often involved stockpiling stuff, but I didn't have any operational space for an e-commerce business. So a lot of my event space had been kind of cannibalized by office space and or e-commerce shipping stations. So I wasn't real happy with the way my event center was. And I just had a lot of product. I often tell people, I no longer had room to experiment, whether that meant new product lines or just having fun with displays. I think my sales were actually suffering because I had so much product, and I'm a merchandising guy. Merchandising is very important to me, and I was not happy with it over there. So that's what initiated it, was my lease was running out and I needed more room. And not for nothing, the shopping center that I was in had, let's politely say, decayed around us since we'd been there. We moved into that space in March of 2013. And we'd effectively become the anchor in a lot of ways in that shopping center. There had been some ownership changes in the shopping center over the years, and it hadn't been maintained the way that I would like. And the neighborhood sort of changed, not for the better. Store's big enough that the nerds found us, and I say nerds with love, but all the gamers could find us. But more and more of our business was coming from casual gamers, or people that would never use the word gamer to describe themselves, more kids and families. And the perception, true or not, perception is everything. The perception of that other shopping center was that it, maybe wasn't the safest place. So I moved not even 9 minutes down the road, and I'm still in the same zip code, but shopping center's night and day. And my new store is 3.5 times the size of the old one. So
is this the store's first overall move?
It's the third.
Oh, wow. So where did you originally start, and how small was that store when compared to now where you're located?
So give you a little bit of background here. I'm not the original owner. The original owner, much like Travis from Millennium, the original owner is named Ed. His name is Ed Sloman, was the original owner, and I'd known him for years socially. He had bought the shop in 2000. It used to be a trading card shop, not necessarily gaming, but from what I understand it was sports cards that had started really doing some business in Magic. And it was a totally different kind of operation. He assumed ownership of the store basically by assuming the debt. So he didn't pay anything. He just assumed the debt of the old store. And that was a tiny little space. I couldn't even guess that first location. And back then it was called Games and Comics and Stuff. He carried a little bit of indie comics, but it was never really a full-fledged comic store. But I think that first location, I think the sales floor couldn't have been 300 square feet. I mean, it was tiny, with a funky little hallway that had a little bit more product. And then in the back, there was a game room that was pretty big compared to the size of the store. I don't recall how long he was there, but then he moved to the second location about a block away that had 2 floors. The second floor was the game room. It was an old bridal shop. which lent for some interesting risers and things on the second floor. Because if you look carefully, you could see where the mirrors on the wall, where the brides used to, you know, sort of spin in the mirrors or whatever. I mean, that shop, I bet it wasn't, man, I bet it was maybe 1,500 square feet, maybe 2,000. I bet it was 1,500 square feet, not very large. So in 2009, so he opened January 1st, 2000. So, and at some point he moved to the second location. In 2009, I moved back to the area. I'm originally from the area, but I spent some time in Jersey. And I was kind of rebooting my life, as it were. I'd gone through a divorce. I'd left my old career. And just on a very part-time basis, he had asked if I'd wanted to come on and help out with board games. My background is really in board games and role-playing games. Those are my passions. I play a little bit of everything, but those are my roots. And it was, you know, 2009 was right when board games really were starting to do something special in the U.S. So he'd asked that I start running some board game nights for him. He just didn't have a real board game enthusiast on staff. So it was very part-time. And I started running those and offering buying suggestions because, you know, he didn't have the stuff that mattered at the time. Well, I came from corporate retail. I spent the entirety of my life. I started in record stores back when every mall had four record stores, worked for various regional chains. And I would later go on to manage stores for Hot Topic when they were first expanding to the East Coast in an aggressive way, and did everything you can imagine for them. I did a little bit of buying, did a little bit of recruiting, did training. But I came from, you know, regional and large corporate chains. So I had a very different perspective when I came in. So while I was helping out with board games, my nature was very much, you know, like, hey, can I re-merchandise this display? Or, hey, I noticed you got a lot of D&D, but you don't have Shadowrun. I really love Shadowrun. Can I bring in Shadowrun? So I started helping out in different ways, to the point where we started calling me the special projects manager, even though I was still very part-time. Well, as luck would have it, he had cause to get rid of his store manager in late 2010, and I got a phone call from him and said, you know, I'm getting rid of this guy. Would you be willing to take over management of this store? Now, I'm not really a guy that's motivated by money, but I said, look, I've got these other jobs. I said, if you want me to manage the place, I would like you to pay me enough so that I can quit these other jobs so that I can really manage this place. So I can do it right. So we came up with a salary and an incentive program based on sales, came to an agreement, and I took over in, I think it was August of 2010. And pretty much since month two of me in that position, I acted like I owned the place, and I made a lot of changes. And very quickly, I tripled the sales. And we were in that location until March of 2013, when we moved to our recently vacated location, which was 7,700 square feet, split between retail and game room. That store I basically designed, both merchandising wise and sort of visual design wise. And from there, we kind of took off like a rocket and never looked back. So we were there for about 10 and a half years. And, you know, we just moved to this location, which is 25,000 square feet total. My sales floor is 14,000 square feet, and I don't remember the square footage of the event center, but it's quite large. By my reckoning, only Travis at Millennium is bigger than me, which he likes to remind me of. There are very few stores of this scale. You know, it's probably, you know, Gordon at the Century Box up in Canada and Madness Games and Comics down in Texas, maybe a couple others. But yeah, it's really me and Travis that are just game stores, and, you know, some other things. I mean, you know, my store's called Games and Stuff. There is some stuff in here. But we're predominantly game stores, whereas some of the other bigger ones are comics and games.
And when you were making those changes at the time, prior to taking ownership of the store, was there any pushback from the original owner? Granted, like you mentioned, you tripled the sales. I'm curious, though, if you received any hesitation from him when you were saying, I'm going to redo, you know, the store essentially.
Not really. He trusted me. Like I said, we had a pre-existing relationship prior to a professional one. Weirdly, he was actually the ex-boyfriend of my first ex-wife of my ex-wife. So it's kind of, so, but we were all cool. Like, in fact, when my first wife and I were married, I that's how I met him. So everybody was, you know, there was nothing weird. We were just all friends. So he trusted me. And I think that enabled me to, kind of make the bold changes that I was doing. Like, early on, he had this very structured formula for how much money I could spend on restocks every week, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think I lasted 2 weeks and I just started spending what I wanted to. And I used to do a lot of peer-to-peer education, teaching and presenting to other game store owners and managers. Like Travis, I was involved in the Gamma retail board for a while. I was the secretary for 4.5 years. But I did a lot of retailer education. And one of the stories I often tell in one of those classes I used to teach was people always ask, how do you go from a store that orders one or two of a thing to a store that orders 10 or 12 of a thing? And I always tell the story. I said, you just got to pick the thing. You just pick the game or the SKU or whatever, the item that you believe in, and you decide, I'm going to make this a hit. And for me, it was Ascension. I don't know if you remember Ascension, the deck builder game, but it was the second one to market after Dominion. It was released at Gen Con of that year, had some art that was sort of divisive. Like some people loved it, some people didn't like it. But it was really the second deck builder to market. And it had some buzz coming out of Gen Con. And I said, I think this is a thing. I said, I think I'm going to sell this to board gamers. And I think I might even get some Magic players involved because there were some ex-Pro Tour players that were involved in the design of the game. And at the time, I took a really big swing, which was 18 copies. I said, I'm going to bring in 18 copies of this thing. And Ed had never done anything like that for anything that wasn't Magic. And he said, you know, he did some paper napkin math, and he said, oh, that's such and such dollars tied up in one game. Like, I trust you to do it, but it better sell. I said, I'll sell it. So I think I restocked week two. So I sold 18 of them within, you know, 10 or 14 days time, and I was restocking by week two. And I just decided I was going to make it a hit. And, you know, and I think he kind of trusted me from then on as far as buying went. And the merchandising end of things, I mean, you know, he didn't really come from a retail background. So I think, you know, he could just visually see the results of what I was doing. And then, of course, the results in the cash register. And he kind of trusted me. So there wasn't a lot of pushback.
And what drew you to get involved in the business as well? Is it just from the standpoint that you were already had the experience with retail? Like you had mentioned, you worked at record stores and you worked at big box retail. So was that what drew you to the game store business, or was there something else that drew you, like your love of board games and role-playing games?
Yeah. I mean, it was both, right? I mean, it was like, you know, it was chocolate and peanut butter right together. Like I'd spent literally my entire adult life in retail management. I liked retail. The few times that I, you know, took a brief office job, whatever, I missed retail. I didn't like sitting on my butt. I didn't like looking at the same faces every day. And the fact that I'm just a big gamer, meant that I could share my passion with other people. And in fact, I you know, I kind of instilled that in my staff. I said, I never want you to feel like salespeople. I said, think of yourselves as vectors of enthusiasm. Like we get to sell fun for a living, right? So I never want you to feel like, you know, you're trying to sell somebody something. Instead, you should just be having a chat with them and finding out what sort of things excite them, what their particular brand of game is, or what, you know, what kind of games they like. And then, you know, following on from that conversation, showing them other stuff that they might think is cool. Sometimes it might not even be stuff that you think is cool as the sales associate. But if you can talk to your customers and you know your product, you should be able to, you know, sort of share with them other things that would be exciting to them. So, you know, I mean, people come into game stores because they're excited about what we sell. They're spending, they're spending expendable income on a thing that's a passion of theirs. And for many of them, it forms part of their identity. So the fact that we can kind of be the vector through which they experience that passion, you know, means a lot. And, you know, there was a brief moment during COVID when I thought, well, what happens if this becomes an online only business? And I very quickly realized I'd get out of it. I wouldn't want to be, you know, that's not why I got into retail. Like I like talking to people and sharing face-to-face enthusiasm about stuff. If I was just packing boxes all day long and that's how we, you know, if it's how we temporarily survived, great. But if it's how we did the whole thing, I think I'd get real bored real fast.
And, you know, you mentioned something interesting there that piqued my attention, which was that, you know, you genuinely like people, which, and to work in retail is something that you kind of have to have. What do you think? Because a lot of people do have that difficulty with working retail because dealing with the general public could sometimes be, you know, a difficulty. So what's been your approach with working in that space for as long as you have been?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, particularly in this industry, right? I mean, they're, you know, the negative stereotypes of crappy game stores exist for a reason, because there's a lot of them out there. You know, it's relatively cheap to start. You know, you can throw a couple of boxes of Magic on a shelf and call yourself a game store. But it's real easy to become, you know, the comic book store guy from The Simpsons, right? Just looking down your nose like, oh, you still play Warhammer? I play this other thing that's cooler. Or, oh, you play that color deck? You know, it's real easy to get real snobby real fast. I don't have a lot of patience for that. I don't have a lot of patience for that for my customers. But as far as you know, dealing with people, you know, I mean, it's a job like anything else, and I expect my people to take it seriously. But I also like to remind my employees when things get stressful, particularly if it involves a customer, I just say, hey, remember, we're selling toys to grownups. Like, we get to sell toys to grownups for a living, or sometimes not grownups, right? But like, we're selling Space Marines and Planeswalkers, you know, and board games. Like this should be fun. You know, none of this is life and death. You know, this is a very serious business. You know, we have a lot of volume. I have a lot of employees. You know, we take it seriously, but at the same time, it's just toys, man.
And speaking of fun, I wanted to touch more a little bit about your love of board games and role-playing games. What are some that you enjoy playing, and why did you like them when, you know, you learned about them? What kept you coming back to it?
So I've been playing games my whole life. I mean, I just turned 49 years old, so I've been around since the mid 70s, and I can remember as a 5 year old, you know, in like 79 or so. I have an older brother who's 7 years older than me, and as a 5 year old, I was playing Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. Like my brother, you know, was leading me through adventures as a 5 year old, creating my own character, etc. And we always had board games. My father played board games with us, whether it was Monopoly or you know, I have very clear memories of playing the original Dark Tower when it came out in 81. You know, we always had games. I had this very, very clear memory of I was living in Jersey at the time as a little kid. We had, they're not really in fashion anymore, but we had these closing, I don't even know which call them, sort of like saloon doors, but they didn't swing. They latched closed. This pair of doors that you could close off between the kitchen and the dining room. And I can remember my older brother setting up a game of Risk on the dining room table. And this was the 80s version when the pieces were all plastic and they were shaped like little Roman numerals. And I can remember him setting up this game of Risk. And I didn't really understand the game, but I can remember looking at all those pieces on that map and just thinking, wow, every one of those pieces is meaningful and it means something in the context of the story that's about to unfold. And me just being a little kid, my bedtime was coming up and I can remember these doors closing and like closing me off from the wonder that was about to happen on the other side of the doors as I was sent off the bed. I just have these very visceral memories of playing games as a young kid. You know, and Lord of the Rings was hugely important to me as a kid, particularly the 70s cartoons, the Rankin-Bass ones. So I've sort of been immersed in this stuff in my whole life. So I played Dungeons & Dragons and board games very early on. And then high school and college, I played a lot of Shadowrun. And then as board games really started to take off again in the early 90s, I you know, went from having a few board games on a shelf to, you know, slowly amassing a collection similar to what a lot of people have now. So yeah, you know, I played Magic when it first came out. You know, like many people, I could tell you a tear-filled story of how I got rid of the cards that were in my Alpha starter deck that I bought at the Philadelphia Comic Book Convention the year that came out.
Oh no.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't tear-filled at the time. I mean, I had the three blue cards, not the mocks, but I had, what was it? Time Twister, Time Walk, and Ancestral Recall Alphas. And I sold them in the mid-90s for $180 in cash, which at the time was mind-blowing, right? Like mind-blowing. I remember walking into the shop that was near me at the time, and I knew the guys pretty well. They ran a comic and game store in a mall where I was running a store, and the clerk was on the phone, and he walked in, he sort of waved me hello because he knew me, and I just held up the cards in front of him, and he's on the phone, he looks at me and he sort of mouths, are those real? And I said, oh yeah. And he says, hey, I gotta call you back. And he, you know, he offered me $180 on the spot. And again, mind-blowing. Sure, I'll walk with $180 in cash for three trading cards. What's that guy, crazy? So, I mean, whatever. I mean, I, you know, whatever. No regrets, right? Like, I mean, I'm sure that $180 made a huge difference at the time. But, you know, now it's a car, but, you know, or more. But yeah, so I played Magic for a few years when it first came out. You know, I played, I got into miniatures games through Games Workshop. I mean, being from Baltimore, Games Workshop for over 20 years, their U.S. headquarters was based in Glen Burnie, not 10 minutes from where my store is today. So the fact that I could go to the Games Workshop U.S. headquarters, you know, I discovered Talisman, the board game Talisman first, and then I discovered Blood Bowl was my first miniatures game. And then I played Warhammer 40K for many, many years. So yeah, I dabble in a little bit of everything.
I love that your whole background with games comes from the family dynamic to start off. I like that that's the starting point, you know, rather than it coming later in life. I like that it started that early on for you, like me between you and your brother.
Yeah. And my dad too, like we played a lot of board games. I mean, my dad has long since passed away at this point, but much like I never beat him at miniature golf, I also never beat him at Monopoly as a kid.
You know, it's funny with Monopoly. I never realized that that game could end until I watched a documentary on Monopoly and seeing when it's played correctly rather than through house rules, yeah, that the game actually can end.
Well, it's even like Talisman, right? Like everybody's like, oh, the game takes 6 hours. I was like, no, it doesn't. If you're playing to win, you can be done in 90 minutes. But if you're playing to see all the cards, you'll be there forever. If you're just playing it like some sort of, you know, diet version of a role-playing game where you can go explore stuff. I mean, rock on, but you'll be there all day. But if you're playing to win, you can be done in 90 minutes.
Right. It puts it all into context at that point.
Right, right.
So are you finding these days, you know, especially with the move with the new store, are you finding your time more limited to be able to play these games that, you know, drew you to everything, or do you still find the time?
Oh yeah. I mean, I also have a 3-year-old. You know, and my personal relationships are pretty wonderful but complicated. So it's like, you know, between the growing success of the store and the ways in which the fact that I interact with the business in a very different way than I used to, and the fact that I have a 3-year-old and a lot of other things going on in my life, I don't play as much as I used to. You know, I still play some board games, you know, pretty regularly, but it tends to be lighter fare. The people in my life tend to, you know, prefer stuff that plays a little quickly. You know, I don't get to play, you know, 12-hour games of Rune Wars or stuff like Twilight Imperium or anything like that anymore. And again, I also have a 3-year-old who, you know, requires a lot of attention. So I don't play as much. Before pandemic and before my son was born, I was really into KeyForge. We still have a pretty enthusiastic KeyForge community here at the store. So I was playing that competitively for a while. I'm traveling to a lot of vault tours and things. And I still play that, but not, you know, I was playing twice a week, running all the events at the store and then traveling for vault tours and things. But, yeah, between the escalating responsibilities at the store and, being a parent, I haven't had as much time lately. But it's important. I think it's important just so you know, what's going on. And a lot of the travel that I do is so that I can play things, make educated decisions about, you know, the sort of things that I think will do well at the store, or the sort of things that I think will do well on a demo table at the store. So I still play, but I mean, it's considerably less at the moment.
Do you think, because you'll hear this a lot, you know, people start up businesses for the love of it, for, you know, it's a hobby of theirs, whatever avenue of business it might be. And then as time goes on, you start to hear people say, you know, as things go on with anything, it becomes a job after a while. And it kind of, you sometimes could lose your lust or, you know, the fun of it all. Do you ever find that seeping in at all? I've never asked a game store this question before, but it kind of popped into my head just now, just knowing that, you know, owners like yourself and, you know, Travis, like we were mentioning earlier, you know, it's a very busy and it takes up a lot of your time. So I'm curious how that plays a factor.
Not for me, no. But again, I came from, you know, a lot of game store owners, you know, kind of got into it because they bought themselves a job, right? It's sort of like, oh, they're former military or they hate their desk job and they've found some way to be the owner of a store or the manager of a store where they can get a salary, pay their bills, pay the business's bills, and not hate their life and be surrounded by things that they love, right? While I am surrounded by the things that I love, I also came into this as a business person and as somebody who was a retailer. So my approach from the beginning was pretty different. I mean, there was a point fairly early on in the conversations with the previous owner of games and stuff when we were talking about you know, looking towards me buying the place, where I said to him, I said, I think I have achieved a level of success at this store and a scale at the store that you never wanted or asked for. And he said, absolutely. You know, it's not, he, you know, this, that's not why he got into this, was to pilot this behemoth. Right. And it got to the point where when I bought it, you know, he had largely stepped away in a lot of ways, and he didn't want to be responsible for this behemoth. You know, he was a magic guy and a D&D guy, and that was mostly what he was playing. And he enjoyed being surrounded by that stuff. But when the thing became, you know, a much, much larger endeavor, he was, you know, he didn't really, that's not really what he wanted. So no, I don't begrudge their success, and I don't feel like none of the passion of the games has gone away for me. You know, in fact, it's just a different kind of game, right? Like trying to figure out how to make this thing succeed, how to make sure you got enough of the new magic set, or not too much in the new magic set. How do I make sure I've got, you know, 6 months of supply on the hot new board game, because I know the print run's going to be sold out, and I know the publisher's not prepared for its success, so they're going to be out. So how do I make sure I've got enough to last me, so that I'm the guy that's got the thing that everybody else wants? You know, it's all a game. It's just a different kind of game. You know, it's a resource management board game in real time and real scale.
That's a great way to put it. I never thought of it that way, but it makes a lot of sense. What from your past experience with, you know, working in retail for as long as you have, do you think you're able to carry with you into the game store?
Well, so there's two things. First is the merchandising skills that I acquired. You know, again, to speak to the game store stereotype, and, you know, I think game stores overall have gotten a lot better in the last 10 years. But a lot of them, you go in and they're sort of clubhouses for dudes, right? Like, you know, there's a certain way that they're lit, a certain way that they smell, maybe, forgive me, but like, it's true. You know, or the way that they're stocked, right? You know, like every time I walk into a game store and the board games are alphabetized, I twitch, because I know they do it because it's easier for the staff to find what they're looking for, but nobody shops that way. I mean, if a diehard board gamer knows what they're looking for, sure, they can find it, right? But nobody's going to accidentally stumble on games that they might like based on other things that they know they like, if it's all alphabetized, right? Without any sort of sectioning or departmenting. So my sense of merchandising, of like what, you know, what a well merchandised store looks like and how it's lit and how it's laid out and the flow of product, you know, all of that came from, you know, corporate retail. The other thing, and I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, talking about how, you know, the core gamer customer is one that's here because they want to be. They've got disposable income. They're spending on a thing they're very passionate about, that they're very opinionated about, and probably form some part of their identity. That's very similar to the customers that I had at a record store or at Hot Topic when I worked for them, right? Much like, you know, at Hot Topic, I got the, you know, 16-year-old kid that comes in with a mohawk who identifies as a punk because of the music that he listens to, and he's got his, you know, his paycheck from his other job, and he's there to buy a t-shirt or a CD. Like, you know, I mean, there are people for, you know, we use the phrase, you know, lifestyle players, magic all the time, right? Like, there are people that play magic and that's the thing they play. They don't give two craps about anything else that I sell. They're just here for magic. And it is their core hobby, and it is a core part of who they are and how they identify. So the fact that, you know, and they're very, very knowledgeable and very opinionated. And the fact that they choose to engage with that passion through me is not dissimilar to all those years I spent working at record stores or similar businesses.
And with the importance that you laid out with merchandising and buying, is that your role these days, day to day with the store, due to, you know, how much you have going on in your personal life, as just well as being an owner of the store?
Yeah, I mean buying first and foremost, and vision, sort of overall vision of what I want the store to be. You know, I've been thankful enough in the last couple of years as we've been aiming toward this new location, that my girlfriend has really assisted so much, sort of invisibly, with helping with marketing and really putting me in touch with some next level partnerships as far as marketing and design and things like that, to really kind of take it to the next level as we move to this new phase of the store. but you know, it's about the vision and what I want the store to be, and the buying. It's funny, like for all the years that I managed games and stuff before I owned it, I had taken over so much of the day-to-day operations and doing a lot of the travel. And I was sort of a more outgoing personality than the old owner, that a lot of my contacts in the industry simply assumed I was the owner. So when they found out that I wasn't, or that I was in the process of buying it, they were very surprised. They're like, "Oh, I thought you were the owner." I'm like, "Oh, that other guy's the owner. Oh, I never would have guessed." And part of moving into this new location was also, okay, well, now that we're making a move and the store is wholly mine, figuring out how to inject some of me into the store, whether that's visually or spiritually, if you will, like the way we present ourselves to the world, was kind of an interesting and fun challenge. When I bought the place, I very briefly considered changing the name, because Games and Stuff, it's sort of generic. One of the words is in the name of every game store, and one of the words means nothing. it's not very iconic, right? That being said, I didn't consider that very long because, again, I had been the face of the business to the point where, I had become synonymous with the brand, and changing the name would have been counterproductive. So I kept the name. As we kind of went through a rebranding a year and a half ago with our new logo and whatnot, we thought about maybe tweaking the name, but ultimately we decided against it and just went for new visual impact, new color scheme, new logo, things like that. But yeah, kind of trying to inject myself into the game store that is the game store of my dreams, and kind of having the overall vision. And yes, buying. I often joke, as I get older and I think about, what the future looks like, and how, I can hopefully get other people involved in the business that are, responsible for some of the things that occupy my days. I mean, for example, just a few months ago, I hired a woman to take over merchandising full time. But I often joke, you'll pull buying, particularly board game buying, but role playing too, but board game buying from my cold dead hands. Like that's the part that it's the game that I talked about earlier, right? Like really trying to figure out how to make that work. And it's why I'll put my board game department against, anybody within multiple states, or my role-playing department for that section, for that matter. But I've got, being 10 minutes from the Games Workshop headquarters for all those decades means there's a lot of wargaming and miniatures games in the bedrock around here. So I've got a lot of, hardcore GW people and staff and on my management team. So, my miniatures selection is no joke either. I mean, we do a lot of stuff with miniatures, but again, because we're kind of where Games Workshop started in the US, this market more than probably any other market I've seen. I mean, I think you can go to most cities and find shops that are basically magic shops. Like, sure, they carry maybe a smattering of other games, but mostly they're there to support a magic community. Here, you can find stores that are just miniature stores. And I don't think there's very many of those around the country, certainly not as many concentrated in the area. I mean, I should note that, in the 70s and 80s, Baltimore City was also where Avalon Hill was based, which is the historical war game company. They since got, bought by Wizards and Hasbro, and the brand exists, but it's not what it used to be. But because of Avalon Hill being here for all those years, and Games Workshop being here for all those years, like, historical wargaming is very much, as I say, in the bedrock around here.
We're going to take a quick break from this podcast to talk about our sponsor, Cardboard Shuffle. Cardboard Shuffle was our 10th podcast interview here at the Match Slip with store owner Mark. Mark has expanded his brand and has produced his own card sleeves called Shuffle Shields. Shuffle Shields come in packs of 100 premium matte card sleeves for standard size trading cards. They contain no PVC and are acid free. I have 17 packs of Shuffle Shields card sleeves to give away to listeners of the podcast and followers of the Match Slip on social media. Requests for a free pack of card sleeves shipped for free to you will be processed on a first come, first serve basis. To receive your free pack of Shuffle Shields, you'll need to send a screenshot that you're following Cardboard Shuffle on Facebook to frank@thematchlip.com. Good luck, and back to the episode.
I know you mentioned your girlfriend is helping with the marketing efforts. So with that in mind, how do you make the buying and purchasing decisions to make sure you're not ordering too much or too little? when factoring in that those marketing decisions?
Well, so marketing for us has really become about, two things. So we've got the e-commerce site, which again, prior to 2020 wasn't even a thing, and about sort of growing the brand. So there's two concerns there. So I'll talk about the brand first. So, you know, when people talk about game stores they want to visit, you know, that might not be anywhere near them, the list is usually pretty short. You know, they talk about maybe Mox out in the Northwest, or they talk about Snakes and Lattes up in Canada. You know, these stores have a lot of brand awareness. You know, for Snakes and Lattes, it was the fact that they were basically the first board game cafe to make a go at it. And Mox obviously has sunk a lot of money in design into the way their stores look. So people walk in and they're kind of wowed. And there's a couple others throughout the country. But, you know, there was a conversation that happened a couple years ago, which was the industry knows me and they know the store. And it's spoken of in very respectful tones. But I don't know that consumers across the country do. So very much part of what we've been doing these last couple of years is trying to raise the brand awareness so that, you know, in a perfect world, any gamer that comes through PWI Airport, which we're very, very close to, you know, we're through the Baltimore, DC area, says, oh man, I got to go check out games and stuff. Like, I just want to be top of mind for when anybody passes through the area. I want to be part of that conversation. You know, no disrespect to those other stores that I mentioned, but I think I'm a better game store than they are. They do other things much better than I do, or things that I don't do at all. They just have a different business model, but it's a straightforward game store. I mean, I don't think there are very many people that do what I do on the same scale. I mean, Millennium being closest, perhaps. So I just, you know, I want to be part of the conversation as people travel the country, be like, oh, I got to go to games and stuff. And it does happen now. I mean, opening weekend, 2 weekends ago, I had a guy come through that was on a 2-hour layover from BWI, and he just bounced over just to see the store and make some purchases on his way home. I've got a regular customer that lives in Texas that passes through maybe twice a year for work and drops $600 or $800 in my used role-playing game department. Again, I see him twice a year, but he makes a point to stop here, you know, as he passes through. So that's one end of the marketing. The other thing is the e-commerce, right? Like, I don't discount online. I'm not trying to compete with Amazon. I think anybody that does, you know, at least in store in within their four walls to try to compete with Amazon is a losing battle. They'll always beat you on selection. They'll always beat you on price. You know, you need to provide other benefits for what people are getting by, you know, when they pay full MSRP for stuff for you. So what I'm good at, as I mentioned, is buying, right? So I'll give you an example. I don't know how familiar you are with sort of board game buzz, but last year, Ark Nova came out, right? It's this sort of engine building game about a zoo. It was from a publisher that often doesn't do very large print runs, but it was getting a ton of buzz. And it was, I think it's $70, $80. It's not cheap. Well, I took a run at it. I was like, you know what? This thing's got a ton of buzz. It's from a publisher that I bet, you know, was a little conservative on their print run. So I went real hard from multiple sources, and I ended up with, you know, a couple hundred of them. So what happened was, you know, I got in my enormous pile of this thing, and it sold very well to my local customers, and then it continued to sell at a slower pace in the coming weeks. But what happened was, as the supply dried up across the country, occasionally people would wander into my store, and at least twice somebody took a picture of my display of this giant pile of Ark Nova and put it in one of the board game groups on Facebook or other social media, and it went viral because they were like, oh, I found all the Ark Nova. Here's where it all is. Like, you can't get it anywhere. You know, it's selling for $150 on Amazon or on eBay, but here it is, regular price, you know, at this store in Baltimore. And then figuring out, so I've got the product. I've, if not saturated, I've at least mostly satisfied my local market. So then I still got stock, which will, sure, I could drip it out to my local market in the coming months before the restock hits. But I know that there's a market for it out there that can't find it. So figuring out how to get my e-commerce site in front of those eyeballs so that they can find it and be like, oh, well, here's a store that's still selling at MSRP. Instead of $150, I'm just going to buy it from them. So the trick is, you know, figuring out how to get in front of those eyes, even if it's in California or whatever. So that's been the other marketing exercise, is figuring out how to do that. And you know, I brought in some third-party marketing companies to assist with that. A lot of times I micromanage it so that, like, you know, when one of those games hits, you know, I can tell, because I'll see, okay, well, here's a game that I've bought a lot of that I believed in. It's slowed down a bit in store, but then suddenly it spikes online. And I'm like, oh, I wonder if it's all gone. And then sure enough, I look around for supply and I'm like, oh, look, nobody has any left. I've still got 60 of them. Well, then maybe that's when I start putting some marketing dollars behind that to make sure that people find my website so that they can buy it from me. Now, does that stop me from putting a handful of them on eBay for $150? No, of course not. But mostly, you know, I'm servicing, you know, my local community, so that even customers further afield. And that's the other thing, is I live in a very, you know, a dense metropolitan area. You know, I get customers from Northern Virginia, from Philadelphia, from other parts of Pennsylvania, from Delaware, from Southern Jersey. You know, the thing about the Mid-Atlantic is that, you know, it's kind of all connected, right? It's not, you know, I'm 2 hours from everywhere. So a lot of times people know that, oh, they can't get this thing. I bet Games and Stuff has it. Or even, you know, other retailers who I'm friends with will say, well, check Games and Stuff, because if they don't have it, then nobody's got it. So I've developed my customer base in that way, locally, or at least regionally, so that, you know, I might not be, you know, somebody 90 minutes away might still go to Bob's House of Games or whatever that's close to them, but they know that I exist. They know I'm the great big store. They come to me when they get their tax return. They come to me for the holidays. They come to me for, you know, for a big pre-release or something. So they might not be an every week customer and every month customer, but I'll see them 3 or 4 times a year. And I've grown my customer base from that. But now what's happening is I'm also growing my customer base nationwide, as I'm able to selectively find these items that have exploded that I have smartly bought into. And now I'm servicing customers all over the country because they can't find the thing because their local store, you know, wasn't quite on the pulse like we are. You know, and I've got some crazy stories about stuff that's not even our usual products that over the last couple of holidays I've been able to act on. And the trick is trying to figure out how to make those customers that aren't your regular customers, that are maybe just buying from your website for the one thing because you got the thing they can't find, and how to try to turn those into return customers. I say that, but for all this talk of, you know, e-commerce, it's still a teensy tiny fraction of my business. You know, 98% of what I do, of what I sell, goes out the front door.
What are you noticing are the most in-demand products, whether it be a particular product line or just volume you're doing at the store? What is the most popular that you're seeing?
I don't know. That's a pretty broad question. I mean, I think if we're talking board games, like, it changes from month to month. Like, and it's usually those instances of, like, here's a thing that had a ton of buzz coming out of convention and supply immediately dried up. And if I was smart enough to buy a ton of them, then I'm going to rake in all those dollars really quickly because I've got 200 and I'm going to sell them very quickly because everybody else is out and I'm the guy that's got them. Magic, you know, if Magic went away tomorrow, it would suck, but I'd be fine. But for all that, you know, when I talk about the sort of broadly the quadrants of my business, right? I've got board games, I've got role-playing games, I've got miniatures games, and I've got Magic. Now, I do sell other trading card games, but Magic is the only thing that I talk about, you know, as an entity on itself, as a single brand, right? So Magic, of course, is still wildly popular and very, very important to us. But again, to the point, you know, I made earlier about we're in a very densely populated area. I mean, there's within an hour's drive, you could probably hit, man, an hour. You could probably hit 15 to 20 stores that run Magic events, if not more. I mean, it's a lot. So we kind of have to find our niche when it comes to Magic. But again, it's very important. Board games, there's always something, right? We do buy a lot of Kickstarters. You know, there's a lot of FOMO that occurs if a Kickstarter hits big. People didn't buy into the Kickstarter. They don't, you know, they don't like doing Kickstarter. They don't like giving money up front, and then they got to wait a year or whatever. You know, then once that Kickstarter starts shipping, you know, FOMO happens all over again because people are like, oh, well, people are talking about this because they're actually playing it now, and it's really exciting, and it's getting released soon. But man, I wish I had that Kickstarter exclusive edition. Well, I've got it, right? So like just today, I received all the new Marvel Zombicide stuff. And the reprint of Return to Dark Tower with the new expansion. So all of that stuff will be up on my website soon, and we'll drive sales for quite a while. You know, Warhammer is hugely important to us. Again, it's, you know, much like Magic or D&D, Warhammer is sort of the the platinum brand in that category. And it will always do well. Anytime there's a new army release or, a new edition of Warhammer 40K or Age of Sigmar, those things do incredibly well. Like, new Space Marine Codex came out last week with some new Space Marine releases. That stuff does great. We're pretty diverse. I don't know if I would point to any one thing that's really, really rocking right now. But being able to pivot, being able to be fast on our feet, is important. During COVID, Pokemon spiked. We made tons of money off Pokemon. Pokemon is, again, an important brand, but during COVID, it went crazy because people were collecting. We're in a much better position with Lorcana than a lot of other folks. So that did wildly well for us. We'll see if they can kind of figure out supply, and we'll see if that continues to happen. It's a lot. And what I tell you today might be different from, 4 weeks from now. Or even, I'm in this new space and I have foot traffic for the first time ever, meaning casual foot traffic, right? Like people can walk past my store and discover it in a way that was never going to happen in the old location. I'm in a full shopping center that has a lot of very successful businesses. So people are seeing, oh, what's that game store? What's that about? And I've got people walking in my doors for the first time. So who knows? It might, I'm expanding my kids' games over here. I'm expanding my sort of impulse purchase gift stuff. I'm expanding books. All of that is stuff that I expect to do much better in this location because my demographic might change. And because I've got different eyeballs in here, and it's a balance to figure out what product categories to expand into outside of our normal game categories that feel like they fit in the store and don't dilute our identity for who we are at our core. But yeah, so I mean, a lot of different stuff does very well, and the answer I give you today might be different than 4 weeks from now or 4 weeks ago.
So with this large number of products that you have and the, various genres of games, what types of events are you running in the store, and which of those events are you finding most popular amongst your customers?
Well, so we pulled back from events, obviously, with COVID, and then post-COVID, we had kind of cannibalized a lot of our event space. And honestly, I just didn't like the way our event room looked because it had been cannibalized for stock or some operational stuff. So I wasn't really leaning into events in the way that we're about to here. We're at this point where, we're in a new space. We still got a lot of sort of bells and whistles that are being added. Just this week, in 2 days' time, we're going to get our all new countertops and some new bookshelves for role-playing games and traditional books that are all arriving this week. I've got a new tournament organizer desk that's going to be built for the game room. So Magic continues to do well, sort of your standards, not standard, but your typical Magic events. Decidedly not standard. So Magic continues to do well. We usually do, fairly large miniatures game tournaments on Saturdays. There's a huge casual Warhammer community. We just had an Infinity tournament. We do an Infinity miniatures game tournament every month. We host a thing called the Baltimore Brawl for Infinity once a year that draws people from, all over the East Coast, sometimes even further. D&D Adventures League is very good. While they're not quite ready yet, I'm speaking to you for one now. We have two private game rooms that will be for rent that will be opening up here. One of them should be ready within the next week or so, and then the other one maybe a month after that. That's something I've always wanted.
Is that related to the open play area I saw on the calendar of your event?
No. So open play is, my game room, I think legally we could seat 260 players or something in there now. I don't actually have the seating for that yet. I've got some new tables being built. But that is, while we have scheduled weekly events and scheduled sort of casual events, anybody that wants to use the game room can come in anytime they want. And it's free to use if you spend $10 or more in the store the same day, or failing that, you can spend $10 to get access, and we'll give you $10 in credit immediately. And then obviously tournaments have their own fee structure or whatever. But the private game rooms will actually just be for rent for full days or half days. We're going to have premium game tables in them. They can seat, I'm expecting them to seat 8 to 10 in each one. One of them is going to be geared toward role players and miniatures players. They're going to have some high-end terrain and some like a full suite of WizKids Warlock tiles. The other one's going to be a little more geared toward board gamers with some, you know, high-end collector's edition of board games that are available. We do have a board game library that's not in the main game room as well. But these are private rooms where sound will be a little more controlled and you can really have the space, particularly for role-playing games. You know, sometimes it's hard to create an atmosphere when you're in a room full of, you know, 80 Magic players. So, and in the fullness of time, we're going to have, you know, full AV hookups and things in these rooms so that people can, you know, project their map on the screen or use any sort of other, you know, audiovisual component they want to do. But yeah, so we're pretty excited about that. It's something I wanted to do for a long time.
That's excellent. And how many employees do you have to help facilitate all that you're doing at the store?
I think I'm currently, we just did a pretty big wave of hiring. I think I'm around 26, 27.
Are they all siloed into their own specialties?
No, some of them certainly are. I've got a store manager and I've got an operations manager. He's now my director of operations. So director of operations helps, you know, manages facilities and, you know, just stuff like paying bills and sort of the mundane crap that I don't want to deal with. But he's also a big Games Workshop guy, so he handles all the Games Workshop ordering because he wants to. And I've got a general store manager and I've got a handful of assistant managers. I've got somebody who's exclusively on Magic, and we're bringing on a few people more to assist him. One of the big things of this space is I have a warehouse. I have a warehouse in my own loading dock, which is huge. I mean, today I got those two Kickstarters. I got 5 pallets of product today. At the old store, we would have been strong arming those off the back of a truck in front of the house. And now I've got a loading dock, a truck can just pull right up to. I've installed 11 foot tall warehouse shelves back there. So I'm going to be getting rid of all those offsite storage units for all my stuff. So I'm reorganizing the company so that now I kind of have a product department. So I've got a receiving manager who's a full-time employee who handles all the incoming product. I'll have a warehouse manager who's going to manage the organization of all that product. And the aforementioned merchandising manager that I brought on a couple months ago, she's going to, you know, she will oversee those other two employees and help facilitate the product, you know, moving out onto the floor and changing up displays or featured displays or things like that. And then across the part-timers, you know, many of them are generalists, but as you might expect, everybody's got their own specialties, right? Like, you know, I've got, you know, people that are more into role-playing games or more into Magic or more into board games. Certain games kind of require specialists. Like, I don't think you can't really be a Magic store without having some Magic specialists on hand. You lose a certain amount of legitimacy. Like somebody, you know, if somebody comes in on Friday night for FNM and wants to talk to you about building a, you know, some tribal commander deck, and there's not somebody on hand who can offer recommendations or kind of chat with them about those things, then, you know, then why would they continue coming there, right? Similarly with D&D, like if somebody wants to come in and wax poetic about their 8th level barbarian, there better be somebody there who can speak the language, you know, otherwise we're just a warehouse full of crap. So I like to try to split the difference between generalists and specialists. As board games have slowly become the most important part of our business over the years, I think it's important to have people that can speak to that, particularly as, it's less important when you've got kind of the super enthusiast, like with Magic or Warhammer or something, that wants to talk about, you know, next level mechanics. Those with board games, at least, they tend to be a little more self, you know, being able to take care of themselves. But with more casual customers that are just discovering us, that are just discovering board games, they really like, you know, having somebody who's going to show them around and be like, oh, this thing would be great for your 6-year-old. Or, oh, you guys really like co-op games, but, you know, you started playing this other thing, but when you play it slightly differently because you don't like head-to-head competition. So you're looking for something that feels a little more cozy. So being able to service the different types of customers is really important. So again, some specialists and some generalists is what we like to do. But, you know, to my point, we've got people that just work in the warehouse. We've got people that just work on Magic. We're sort of changing our operational structure, having moved into this new space.
And what do you feel the size of this new store has allowed? Granted, it provides you the space to have more stuff, but what is like the bigger picture for you that you feel that the size of the space allows?
So there's a couple things. One is just the merchandising. Like, we were just out of room. Board games, for example, had slowly grown to be mostly spined out, right? Like mostly, you know, spined out like books on a bookshelf, and not a lot of space to put things face out. Now, 94% of my stock is faced out again. It's fascinating that people come in, they're like, oh, your board game selection is so much bigger. Like, it's not really. It's just five times the space that we've been able to spread out into with board games. You know, we will expand the selection, but, you know, for now, it's not that different, really. So having the space to really feature products, like in the old store, I mean, I carved out every inch of space possible. I had two front-facing end caps that I used to feature games. And we were always fighting for what should be up there because there was always stuff we wanted to feature and there's not enough room. And I had a sort of this tiered table that was my new releases. And it was just such a crazy balancing act, sometimes literally, to try to figure out how to fit all the new releases on there and how long should something stay. Like, oh, it's still selling well, even though it's 6 weeks old, but it's still selling well off the new release table. Do we move it off? Like, what do we do? Well, now I've got four of those tables. So now I can spread out new releases. Now I've got a dedicated new release miniature section and a dedicated new release role-playing section. I have two separate cash wraps, one of which is just for Magic and people looking for singles. I mean, you can, you know, you buy a board game, you get rung up back there too. But, you know, when our new cash wraps arrive this week, the goal is for that second cash wrap to be mostly Magic and event entry. You know, we're moving from the old store had two functioning registers. We have three now, but then once the new cash wraps arrive this week, we're going to move to five. So, you know, just being able to eliminate lines, especially during, you know, holiday weekends or just successful Saturdays or whatever, just being able to, you know, service more customers in a way so they're not standing in line quite so long. You know, my aisles are huge and wide. You know, there's certainly a wow factor. Like you walk in and people are like, oh, holy crap, this place is huge. I was like, well, yeah, there's not really many bigger. It doesn't get much bigger than this. When I started this process of rebranding a couple years ago, one of the exercises that I went through with some of these marketing companies that I worked with, one of them was, you know, what is your favorite retail experience as a shopper? Like in any, you know, in any industry, what was your favorite retail experience? Now, I don't know if you have these out there where you are, but in the 90s, we had a chain out here called the Nature Company. Now they were eventually bought by the Discovery Channel and they got turned into Discovery Channel stores, which are now gone. But prior to that, before that purchase, they were called the Nature Company. And they were just they were mostly in malls. And they were, you know, I'm a bit of a nature nerd. I love animals and plants and things. And they sold everything from semi-precious stones to little gemstones to, you know, kids' books about nature, a little bit of clothing, you know, just very, very, you know, nature focused, but not, you know, not in a theme parky rainforest cafe kind of way, but in a, you know, in a sort of, hesitate to use the word scholarly, but like a, you know, a very educational way, that was also really cool. Well, back in the 90s, the tourist area in Baltimore was still very bustling in downtown called the Inner Harbor, and the flagship location of the Nature Company was down there. And I brought this up as the example of my favorite retail experience because the way the departments were set up, you know, you'd have your geology stuff here and your kids stuff here and your fossils here and your, you know, zoology stuff here. But there were all these sort of little cubbies, and it felt like around every corner there was some new wonder to discover. And it felt magical, for lack of a better word. It just felt like you were discovering treasure at every turn. And that's something I really wanted to evoke. I'm like, I really want this sense of wonder, almost like Willy Wonka opening up onto the chocolate river, right? Like I want people to walk in and just be like, you know, I'm going to put on a top hat and start singing, you know, come with me, you know, and I just, you know, I want there to just be this sense of wonder, and you're discovering something fun and interesting around every corner. Well, the other thing that the Nature Company did was they had these occasional big displays that were, I think ostensibly they were for sale, but really they were these giant, almost museum-like showcases. And I'm going to give you this example, you know exactly what I mean. But like this flagship location downtown, they had an honest to God, full-size, real Triceratops skull on display in the store. If memory serves, I'm pretty sure it was for sale. but I don't think it ever sold. But, you know, it was this enormous centerpiece in the store. And it was this sort of thing where you walk in and you're just like, holy crap. And if you have any interest at all in natural history or anything, like you immediately be like, you tell your friends, like, you got to see this place. They got a Triceratops skull. So in years past, I've been very averse to having things on display that are just for display in a game store. Now, in recent years, publisher WizKids has done some very cool things, like they've done these like mounted dragon heads that we've got mounted up and stuff. Those are very cool, but most game stores worth their salt have them, right? But I wanted my Triceratops skull moment, and I've got the space to do it. So it's not out there yet because we're building a thing to mount it on. But I'm a huge Lord of the Rings nerd. And my son's name is Pippin. His name is actually Peregrine, but yeah, he's Pippin, so for sure. And the thing about Lord of the Rings is that, yes, it's very nerdy, but it's also one of the most wildly popular movie series of all time, to say nothing of the success of the book. So I think it's a little more accessible than if I put, like a Jace Bellerin statue or something out there, right? So I bought, there was a very limited edition of a company out of Japan worked with one of these collectible companies in the U.S. And I haven't really told the public about this yet. It's just going to be there one day. But I bought a full size bust of Sauron, and he's from the waist up, so he will be 9.5 feet tall in the center of my sales floor. And I'm having a local artisan build a what effectively is a plinth that will sort of look like rocks or whatever, right? But it will be designed in such a way so that nobody's going to climb the thing or whatever, right? So yeah, I'm going to have a full size Sauron in the middle of my store. And a couple years ago I'm also a big Jim Henson nerd. And I bought, full size 1/1 replicas of the door knockers from Labyrinth. So I had those in the old store, but they were kind of like hidden in the back of the game room, and those will probably be out on the sales floor somewhere. So there's just a few of these moments that, that people are going to see. And again, with slightly broader appeal than just a game property, that people are going to be like, holy crap, did you see that thing? And I want people to take selfies with them, hashtag games and stuff or whatever, right? Like I want to create a space where people say, holy crap, not just from the sheer scope of the product assortment that we sell, but that feels like they're seeing something they haven't quite seen before. And a lot of that's the design of the store too. Like the new logo, kind of changed our brand colors to, kind of this deep purple and this electric lime and this lavender. And, I put together a design team when we built the store because I wanted to be very intentional about the way that the store looked. I mean, it's real easy to throw up some racks and throw some games on them and, even be very intentional about the way the merchandising is. But, at some point all the game stores start to look the same. And this is where somebody like Mox has succeeded, right? Like Mox Boarding House, they've got all those wood fixtures and it almost feels like a cigar lounge or something out there, right? So I wanted to be very intentional about the design. So, I don't know how many pictures you may have seen in the new store, but we made some pretty bold choices. Like I have these 12-foot ceilings in this enormous space, and I've got a grid wall display that goes 7 feet up the wall, but then I've got another 5 feet above that. So the walls behind the grid are painted that electric lime green, which sounds insane, but as soon as you put the black grid wall on top of it and then cover it with product, it's not quite as, eye-burning. And there are some spaces that don't have the grid, so you've got these sort of pops of this lime accent color. And then above that grid is all lavender. So when you walk in the store, and all my fixtures, most of them are no taller than 5 feet, I don't like getting lost in a large store like it's a warehouse. There's a couple of game stores that I know that are big and impressive, but they've got these really tall racks, and it just feels like you're in a warehouse. So most of my racks are 5 feet tall. They'll go to 7 feet tall on the wall, the height of the grid. But what that means is, despite the fact that I've got this enormous 14,000 square foot sales floor, you walk in the front doors, and you can see the lavender. You can see the entire perimeter of the store. So when you walk in, you get a sense of the scale of this thing immediately. That's only going to be accentuated by this 9.5 foot tall Sauron in the middle of the thing. But so you get the scale of this thing immediately. Right now, all that lavender space is bare, but in the fullness of time, I'll be doing some funky stuff up there, like I might bring in some street artists to do some things. I have any of my consumers that are listening, any of my customers that are listening to this, they're going to be spoiled for some of these surprises that are coming down the line. But like, A woman I worked with years ago is a neon artist. She's making my new logo in honest, like true neon piping. And that's going to go up there in one spot. So I'm going to have my big rat logo in neon up above one of the walls. So, you know, I think it's real easy to kind of fall into very nerdy decor. I mean, I say that, I'm talking about a giant Sauron on the sales floor, but I mean, you know, we've all seen murals at game stores, right? That are varying degrees of success. Some of them are very cool. You know, there's some cool dragons, you know, kind of have a certain Boris Vallejo vibe to them or whatever. But some of them, you know, some of them are some artist's rendition of Chandra or whatever. And they just, you know, they feel very pigeonholed into a very particular kind of geekdom, if you will. And I think we're going to make some artistic choices here that are a little outsized and very intentional, so that it feels it's not just a bunch of shelves with stuff on it. Like it's a very intentional visual design, and trying to walk the line of how nerdy can I get without alienating the increasingly large part of my customer base that's a little more casual, right? I don't know. It's a fun exercise. But I've got this enormous space with these giant ceilings, and I'm trying to figure out how to make it work for me in a unique way.
I think it's fascinating, the whole layout you've depicted and everything that you're doing to make your store unique, almost like a destination spot if somebody were vacationing. I mean, the fact
that
Yeah, and the fact that you have this nationwide appeal, you know, you have customers from, you know, outside of Maryland, which is great. So to expand into doing that, to like getting more of that nationwide appeal, which it seems like what you're going for, correct me if I'm wrong, are you utilizing, I know you said you do some traveling, are you utilizing conventions as a way to facilitate that?
Well, so in years past, I kind of shied away from selling at conventions. What I quickly discovered, and again, this is pre 2020, was that conventions were a lot of work for low to medium amounts of money, that if I had taken that same amount of work and just put it into my store for a weekend, you know, it would be more successful. Because a lot of times at conventions, the customers at conventions are looking for a particular thing. And it's like, unless I've got something that their local game store doesn't have, or I'm cheaper than their local game store, or, you know, I'm showing them something they've never seen before, you know, what you know, who am I serving, right? I'm like, hey, here I am with that stuff that you can get down the street at your favorite store where you know everybody. So, you know, unless I'm at like a magic convention and I'm just selling accessories, or I, you know, I'm at tiny little convention, like, you know, a couple years ago we had these little very RPG focused conventions here in Baltimore, and I would go there with all my weird indie crap, you know, and I would do pretty well there, but it was very low investment. I usually didn't have to pay for the space. You know, I helped sponsor the thing. You know, and it was local enough that, you know, people might be turned on to us that hadn't learned about us before. And, oh, look, I'm showing I've got indie cred because I sell these funky little indie role-playing games. You know, I was very selective about conventions. Now, with an e-commerce site, you know, the question becomes whether conventions, you know, whether it's a different equation, right? Am I going to pick up new customers regionally if I go to some show that's 2 hours away? And is it enough to make it worth it? You know, am I selling enough product at that show to recoup my costs, you know, let alone make a profit? You know, and am I growing my customer base? And I don't know the answer to that question. Traditionally, it's been no. Traditionally, it's not worth my time. Now there are stores out there who make most of their money going to conventions. I mean, I got a local guy here, Canton Games in Baltimore City, and he's a good friend of mine. I mean, we have a very good relationship. His business model is very different from mine. His store is a fraction of my old store size, but he's in very tight with GCOM. It's called the Games Club of Maryland, and he helps promote their events, and he sells at every one of their events, and he loads his car up, you know, a couple times a year, and I'm sure makes plenty of money and you know, makes a lot of happy customers at these shows. And I just, I'm glad that he does that and he's very successful with it. So on one hand, like, I don't want to mess with what he's got going, you know, cause we have a good relationship, and I mean, rock on if he's able to make a living doing that. But I don't know if that's what I want to be, right? Like, I don't know if I want to, you know, I've already scaled back some of my travel already because I have a 3-year-old, you know? And you know, I know Travis was talking about this, you know, when he was on your show, just, you know, in his new space, he's been so successful that he hasn't been able to even implement some of his new ideas yet. And, you know, here we are, I'm only 10 days in. And there are so many things that I want to do here. The thought of loading up to go to a convention, you know, to try to sell some stuff for a weekend and all the costs that would entail and all the just manual labor that would entail. I don't know what the ROI on that is or whether it's worth it, which isn't to say I won't do things just because I want to. I do that occasionally. Like I got a buddy that runs a show in New Jersey that's very small that unfortunately I had to bail on because as luck would have it, my construction schedule shifted so that my opening weekend was on top of his show. So I had to bail last minute. But, you know, I do that just because I want to go, you know, but I also, it's just me. Like I load up my car and I go and it's just me and I hang out and play games for a weekend and sell some stuff. But, you know, I don't know how many of those people are turning into my customers. And I don't know if I make much of a profit at that show, but that's not why I go. Right. But, you know, I haven't cracked that nut yet. I don't know, you know, prior to having an e-commerce site, the answer was absolutely not. It's not worth my time. It's except for very specialized shows. You know, oh, here's an example. Like, so earlier this year when the D&D movie came out, one of my favorite customers who's helped us in a variety of ways over the years, and he's part owner of a marketing company. There's a local movie theater chain that's owned by one of his marketing company partners that got selected to be one of, I think, four movie theaters in the country to do a special like Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves tavern experience. And it was, you know, about a couple hours away and they were trying to really make this thing into this whole experience. Well, with that, I was like, okay, well, here's this, you know, many hours long event sort of around the different showings of this opening night movie. You know, am I really just going to go up there with D&D books and try to sell D&D stuff to people that are probably already D&D enthusiasts? I'm like, sure, maybe I'll take some books, but like, that's not very compelling. What I ended up doing was I took a lot of D&D adjacent stuff. Like I took a lot of plush and a lot of like, you know, blind box figurines from WizKids and things like that. And it was probably, you know, by the hour, the most profitable convention I've ever done. And I was there for 4 hours, I think. And it was just because I had, you know, it was a very specific audience. And it was a very select product assortment and I did really well, you know, and it was just far enough away that, you know, talking to people, I could be like, hey, if you haven't seen us, we're one of the biggest stores in the country. We're, you know, we're 90 minutes away. You know, if you're ever in Baltimore area, you know, and some people knew who we were already and some people didn't. Some people asked if we carried X or, you know, we could get Y. And I said, yes. And, you know, I mean, that was really positive, but, you know, I think sort of general conventions, I think I'd have to figure out a way to, it's all about the product assortment, right? You can only take so much stuff. And what makes my store so good is the breadth of product. And I can't show that off at a convention. You know, so, you know, figuring out the correct product mix for who the audience is anticipated to be at these shows and also whether or not they care, right? Like, oh, I've got the thing, you're half an hour from home. You could also get it on Amazon for cheaper than I could sell it to you right now. So unless I make a good impression, like, why would you bother, right? You know, or maybe I bring some, you know, occasionally I get a weird game that just for whatever reason doesn't cross over and it really has to be shown to appreciate. You know, so unless I've got a good game for that, that's the right fit, you know, and you never really know until the week before, like, oh, I got the hot new thing. Like, that'll be awesome to take with me because everybody will be talking about this thing and it only just came out. Well, what if I don't have a hot new thing? You know, like I used to vend there was a convention called FairyCon. Again, it was like sort of Jim Henson adjacent, Brian Froud adjacent. And, you know, I vended because I loved the event and I used to support the event. It was very mythology themed and folklore themed. And I would take, you know, a select mix of product there every year and I would sponsor a game room and I did okay. You know, it was like I turned a profit, but barely. It was a lot of work. I really just did it because I liked the show. Well, one year, there's a company that was putting out a Labyrinth board game. And it was the same year that the Frouds, the folks that did all the artistic design and the set design on the movie were going to be there with their son, Toby, now an adult who played the baby in the movie. And I was like, well, it's like 2 weeks after this Labyrinth board game comes out. So I ordered an astronomical amount of this Labyrinth board game. The release date got delayed, but I saw it was in stock at the warehouse. So I reached out to the distributor and I said, "You actually have this in stock?" And they said, "Yeah." I was like, "But the street date's not until 2 weeks from now." And they said, "Yeah." I was like, "Well," I said, "I don't know if I'm going to want 150 or whatever that I ordered if I get it 2 weeks from now. I was getting it in anticipation of this show." So we ended up reaching out to, turns out some of the primaries behind this publishing company were ex Games Workshop folks, and my operations director knew one of them. So we reached out and we said, "Hey, we have this special opportunity. If we could sell this game at this show, it would be there right next to the people who designed, you know, the look of the movie, you know, with the kid who was the baby in the movie. Is there any way you'll let us have it early?" And they said, "Yes." And they said, "Sure." They said, "Absolutely." He said, "You know, with the caveat that you don't sell it. If you've got anything left, you can't sell it at the store until after street date. Like, you can just sell it at the convention." I said, "Great." So they let us do it. I took 150 copies of the show to the show. And I was across the aisle from where Toby was signing autographs. So people would come to my booth, buy the Labyrinth board game, walk across the aisle, unwrap it, and Toby would sign it for them. So I sold 150 of them. And the last one I sold to Toby. It was like, so, you know, so that show was wildly successful from a financial standpoint. You sell 150 of anything and you're in good shape, especially if it's a $50 board game, you know, and it was local, you know, it was 30 minutes down the road. So, you know, looking for those kind of sweet spots when they occur, or leveraging relationships, is really how I like to do conventions. And also, you know, it being 30 minutes away, it's not quite the same investment. It's not like I'm filling a U-Haul full of stuff. You know, it's mostly filling two cars worth or two SUVs worth. So yeah, I mean, did I gain local customers from that? I mean, I don't know if I did, you know, but I sold a bunch of board games that weekend. So I don't know. It's a conventions are funny. They often don't work, but when they do, they really work. You know, I saw that you had teased a previous episode about a guy that goes to many, many conventions a year, and I haven't listened to it yet. I'm curious as to what his deal is. And like, I have some friends who started as retailers and they were so successful at conventions that now they're not really retailers anymore. Now they just sell at conventions and they're manufacturers and they sell things to stores. There's a lot of weird sideways entry points into this industry, particularly on the retail end of things. I just, as I scale back my travel, I just don't know if that's something I want to do. But I'll never say never. You know, again, with an e-commerce site and the attempts to sort of raise the brand awareness nationwide, who can say?
That's understandable. It's definitely, you know, when you have to weigh the pros and cons of it and determine what's best for you and your store, I completely get that. You know, even when you mentioned, you know, how much product you have and are you really able to realistically bring that all on the road to a convention? Yeah, I completely see where that could be a question top of mind when it doesn't fully showcase the store as you may want it to. So, you know, with that in mind, what would you say with moving to the new location and having all of this product and all of this space, what's been one difficulty that you've felt early on that that you've been experiencing that you're like, okay, this is something I kind of know I have to tackle?
Flow of product, both supply of product to the store and flow of product from my warehouse to the sales floor. We were very much in a model where we would do restocks maybe twice a day, once in the middle of the day, once in the evening. Or on a busy Saturday, we might do it three times a day. Our increased volume here so far has been such that we need to do them much more frequently. And we also have a brand new point of sale system because the one that we used to use got discontinued this year, and which made for awful timing moving into a new space and having to deal with the new software. So, you know, I kept joking. I said, I wish they discontinued this thing a year ago or a year from now. Would have been a lot less stressful. But so figuring out that while also figuring out sort of, you know, just the sales volume that we've got going on and the flow of product to the store and throughout the store. You know, we're only 10 days in, so this might be the honeymoon period, right? I was telling my magic manager today, I said, you know, my corporate retail days, anytime you open the new store or you remodeled or moved, you know, we always had a 90-day honeymoon period where you weren't judged on your sales figures because they just assumed you were going to have, you know, a new store opening spike. So, you know, trying to guess how much of this is just novelty and how much of it is here to stay because the store is better merchandised. We've got new customers coming in. We won't really know until, and we're also going into fourth quarter. So I don't think we're really going to know, you know, what the new normal is until maybe February. So just trying to stay on top of the flow of product has been the biggest challenge. And staffing. Staffing is always an issue. You know, there's a million game stores around. There's so many in this market. I mean, we are still a specialty retail store, which is, you know, the overall profit margins are a challenge always. I mean, margins are getting carved out from under us here, there, and everywhere. Publishers are reducing their discounts. You know, we're paying more and more for shipping. So, you know, figuring out, you know, what the new normal for sales looks like, what, you know, how closely that aligns with my projections. You know, the fact that I spent an obscene amount of money building this place, like figuring out what, you know, the new financial equation looks like, how many people I need to hire, realistically, what kind of raises I can give. I mean, I'm a people first kind of person. Like, nobody's in this to get rich. I mean, I'm in retail. Like, I'm not the Walmart guy. Like, I'm not gonna get crazy rich from doing this, but I would like to be comfortable, and I'd look at my employees to be comfortable. I mean, my ultimate goal is, you know, I want to increase profits and increase sales so that I can give everybody raises. Like, that's really what motivates me. I want people that work here to feel like they have a real job and a real career, even though they work at a game store. You know, having worked in retail most of my life, you know, the number of times that I you know would get from people that, you know, this sort of idea that, you know, I didn't have a real career because I worked in retail. You know, I mean, screw those people. Like, I want all my employees to feel like they've got a real job, you know, and some of them are just here, you know, biding their time while they finish school or while they finish whatever. But for the people that want to stay on full time, I would, you know, I want them to feel like they've got a really real job. They've got a grown up job, whatever. So ultimately, you know, finding the people who want to commit to what we do as a career, you know, I'm not getting any younger. You know, at some point I got to think about what the future of this place looks like, whether that means I find somebody crazy enough to buy it from me, or, you know, I become an absentee owner, and because I've got capable people in place to keep it running without me. I mean, I just signed a 10-year lease, so I'm not going anywhere anytime soon, but, you know, but I'm of the age where, you know, it's worth thinking about, like, what the future of this place look like, and what's the future of all these people that have entrusted their livelihood to me look like. So yeah, they got real serious real fast talking about challenges, but you know, I want to take care of my people. You know, and right now that means figuring out what the new normal looks like, what the new scale of operations looks like, figuring out what the growth opportunities are, figuring out, you know, how much of our customer base might change. I mean, I don't think we're going to lose anybody from the old location. I mean, there might be some, right? Like, I mean, we're 9 minutes away from the old location, 9 minutes further south. I mean, you know, maybe that's just far enough so that people don't want to visit us anymore. We're a little further from public transit. So who knows, right? But I do anticipate a pretty large influx of new faces, and figuring out what those people are here to buy, what they're excited about, and how that might change my product mix. I don't know. It's going to be a fun project.
So on the flip side of that, getting away from the difficulties, this is probably one of the last questions I had here for you. This is almost it could be a lofty idea. It could be something you're thinking about for the future. I mean, you just moved to a new store, so I know that was one thing you wanted to accomplish. But what is a future goal if you were to, like, say, you know, they always use the typical thing in business school. If you were forecasting, say, 5 years out, or, you know, if you could do something at a certain point in time that you would like to further do for the store, just like the Sauron bust that you're doing to help elevate it, what's a future goal you have?
I would really like to have a considerably more robust event schedule. We had kind of pulled back, both unconsciously and consciously, from events post COVID, because of COVID and because our game room was not what I would consider up to snuff. So now that we have a nicer space, I would really love our event schedule to be considerably more robust. I really want to get these private game rooms finished with full audiovisual suites and just see these things full all the time. I mean, that's going to be a bit of a puzzle, right? Like what's an appropriate cost structure look like so that these things are full all the time. I mean, that's the big thing for me right now is events. I think events and these private game rooms. I want these things bustling all the time. And, you know, I have a lot of ideas about product expansion. My big ones are things that aren't traditionally game store spaces. Like, I'm doing a lot of gifty things. I really want to lean into books, not floppy comics, or even graphic novels. I'll do some of that. But I've had a fair amount of success with books in a limited amount of space. I want to see if I can really lean into that. A lot of bookstores are going away, or at least sort of changing their business models. And in some of my other previous lives, I had success with books in unlikely spaces. So yeah, I mean, more product diversification while also leaning into our strengths. Like miniatures, for example, had always been a strong point of ours. I would frequently joke with Travis from Millennium, like, you know, we carry miniatures games the way that he carries trading card games, which is he'll try everything for a little while and then move on. Like, we do that with minis games because we've got such a hobbyist community that loves to paint, you know, or loves to try out these little skirmish things. But a lot of times what will happen is we'll bring in some line, and it's one of these games where you only need 10 or 12 models, and somebody will get the 10 or 12 models and they'll get the rule book, and maybe they'll do a second faction and get another 10 or 12 models, and then they're kind of done. And at some point, unless there's continual new influx of players, like, I'm no longer generating sales from that line. So we kind of phase them out and move on to something else. Well, there had been a lot of those miniatures lines that were kind of on the bubble that was like, they did okay, but in our space, they, you know, we really needed the space for something else. So they didn't quite earn their keep. Well, now we got a hell of a lot of space. So now what we're doing is we're approaching some of these publishers, manufacturers directly and basically telling them that story and saying, look, we love your product. We've carried this product in the past. It did okay. Didn't really earn its keep. Can we find somewhere interesting to meet in the middle where, you know, you give me, you know, extended terms on payment, or you give me a little extra discount, or maybe you give me the core of your product line, but I'm allowed to return it in 3 months if it doesn't work out. So just bringing in lines that we love that didn't quite earn their keep and finding creative ways to try them again without quite the same financial risk. We started doing that. So doing that more often, or even some of the publishers that do very well for us really talking like, some almost like grocery store style, like going to some of these companies and being like, hey, I want to give you a wall that's 12 feet long. I want to give you premium placement because I believe in your brand. What can you do for me to help me continue the success of this? And sometimes it's product allowances. Sometimes it's, you know, figuring out unique ways to merchandise. I wouldn't say who it is, but I have, you know, a very prominent brand that I've given a lot of space to, and I reached out to them months ago in anticipation of this move, and I said, hey, I want to build this thing. You know, I know I've been a customer of yours since the beginning, and I'm told I'm your number three customer. I want to be your number one customer. I said, I want to give you this giant wall. Can you guys work with me to figure out a way to brand this thing so that it's like, bam, you've never seen a selection of this particular brand like this before? Well, when we built the store last week, I sent my contact over there some video of this wall that I built, and they were like, oh, well, me and the VP of marketing are going to fly out there in the new year to look at this thing, and we're going to come up with something for you, right? So, you know, leveraging publisher relationships in a way that allows me to highlight their brand in a way that feels unique and special, like I'm a premium store for that brand, is something that I'm really excited to do.
This episode of The Match Slip is sponsored by Crash CityCon, Roanoke, Virginia's premier gaming and fan convention. It's tabletop gaming at its best. In addition to role-playing games, board games, there are vendors, and so much more. Play with some of the top game masters in the area, enjoy a casual game in their open gaming area, or learn to play games you always wanted to play. Attend Crash CityCon August 23rd through the 25th of 2024 at the Berglund Center Special Events Center. You could check out more information at crashcitycon.com.
So as we wrap up here, Paul, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. Where could people who are listening, who maybe want to come visit the store or, check you out online, where could they find you?
So we're at gamesandstuffonline.com. Due to the way that we launched our web store, we currently still have a bit of a Frankenstein's monster of a website. All the updated information is gamesandstuffonline.com. If you go to gamesandstuff.com, that's our old website, but they will soon be merged and you can find everything all in one space. But you can pick a social media platform and we're on there. I mean, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on TikTok, we're on Twitter or whatever it's called now. Like we're kind of all over the place at Games and Stuff, or Games and Stuff MD for Maryland. So we're all over the place. We are maybe 15 minutes from BWI now. So if you ever pass through the Mid-Atlantic, we're very close. You know, if you got a layover at BWI, we're a pretty cool place to come hang out at. I know we're all over the place. I'm involved in all parts of the industry. Travis and I are actually business partners. I'm one of the owners of Free RPG Day with Travis and a couple other buddies. I've also done some design work. I designed a role-playing game for Renegade called Overlight. I still do some occasional freelance writing. I've written for Lord of the Rings and a bunch of other stuff. I'm kind of all over the place, but games and stuff is kind of my main focus these days. So, you know, check us out online or on your preferred social media outlet, or if you're passing through Baltimore, come visit us.
Awesome. And I'll be sure to put links so that people could find you in the show notes for this episode. Paul, I want to thank you again for coming on. It was a lot of fun talking, hearing about the store.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And for everybody else listening, if you'd like to check out my articles that I write that are related to the stores I visit in person, you can get access to those by signing up for my email newsletter at thematchslip.com/newsletter. And with that being said, we will talk to you all in the next episode. Take care.